Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, brought to you by Ham Test Online. And ladies and gentlemen, our guest this week is Dale Pruitt, K1 USA. Now let's find all about Dale right now on QSO. Well, with us today on this edition of QSO is Dale Pruitt, K1 USA. And boy, what a set of call letters.
Yeah.
I bet you a lot of people trying to con you out of those call letters somehow. Does that ever happen?
About every day. Well, probably more than conning me out of it. Most people want to know, or not most, but a lot of people want to know what kind of contest am I running, or what am I doing? What's the special event? I'm telling them it's me, special event me. That's it.
Yeah,
nothing special about this event, I can tell you that for sure.
That's an incredible set of call signs. But I was going to say, of course, you and I have never met, never had a chance to ever talk or get acquainted. So we're just going to start right from the very, very beginning. And okay. Tell us where you're located.
I'm located in a very small town in the state of Missouri. The city is called Lakeway, Lakuey. And as I tell folks on the radio, I'm about 130 miles southwest of St. Louis, Missouri. Not to take anything away from Lakeway, but it's the town is so small, we've got one stop sign. Someone hit it with a truck, so you have the option. You can keep going straight, you can turn right or left, or slow down. It doesn't make any difference. No one cares.
Well, let me ask you this question. What are your interests in ham radio? What is it that you are the most infested with, that you really want to do, that you really enjoy?
Oh, that's easy. That's an easy question. My ultimate goal, if I can live long enough, is to make the DXCC honor roll. That's my goal. And in between that, obviously, is DXing and a little bit of contesting, and I do a little bit of everything. Matter of fact, every September we have what we call the Route 66 on the air special event, and I do that. It's a week long event, and it takes up about a week, and I try to make as many contacts as I can and log in as many folks as I can. And oddly enough, I talk to folks throughout the year. And before I even give them my call sign, they know my name and voice. And the first thing is a lot of folks ask me is, when are we going to do the Route 66? And I said, it's always in September. So, the number one thing for me is DXing.
Well, explain this Route 66 thing, that works. Folks that have never heard of it, they have an interest in it.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's a week long event. There are 17 fixed stations and I think 3 mobile stations along Route 66. It starts up in Chicago and ends in Santa Monica, I believe, California, or vice versa if the host station is out in California. And the call sign is, at least for us here from our club that sponsors it, and from Lebanon, Missouri, it's Whiskey 6 Oscar is the call sign, and it's around mid-September. It's a week-long event, and people are pretty adamant about working all 17 stations. For example, in the state of Missouri, there are three Whiskey 6 stations, Whiskey 6 Papa, Whiskey 6 Oscar, and Whiskey 6 November, I think. But anyway, there's a... last year there was 4, I think, but in the previous years there were 3, one in St. Louis, our club in Lebanon, Missouri, and then over in Joplin, Missouri. But I think they added one this last year in Springfield, Missouri. Unfortunately, I was talked into going out of the country last year, and I didn't get to work it, so I took a lot of heat on it. So I made sure I didn't schedule anything this year around the Route 66. So anyway, you work one or all of all 17 fixed stations or the mobiles that their rovers that go back and forth, and like I said, it's a week long event. Anyone associated with the clubs like ours from Lebanon operates from their home, and you don't have to go to a fixed station like a club station, so you can sit at home, and they're all bands, all modes, and I try to stay on 14.266 as much as possible unless someone else gets there before I do, because it's Route 66. And by the way, if I cut down a couple of trees, I can see Route 66, the original Route 66, from my front porch. So it's kind of fun. I really enjoyed doing that. And like I said, mid-September, and if you Google Route 66 on air special event, it'll give anyone and all the folks some information on that event. And it's a lot of fun.
There was a television show when I was just a kid, and I think I remember it was the name of the show, I think, was Route 66. Am I remembering these two guys in a Corvette or something? It seems like that's what I remember.
Yeah, you're probably dating yourself and myself, but that sounds about right. And it's really interesting. You'll get some of the older hams. I won't say old hams because I consider myself old. Matter of fact, more importantly, this year I'll be 66 years old, so I'll be Route 66 on 66 and 66 this year. So anyway, some of the older hams will come on they'll call you and make contact, and I try to be very polite, and I try to work as many stations as I can. I don't try to make it like a contest, but some of them will get on and they will tell you, back in 1923, Martha and I drove in our 23 Buick from Chicago all the way to California, and they give you the whole story. But it's fun. I mean, it's really a really, really fun event.
Okay, so now, before we came on, and then I was up on QRZ looking at your posts up there, or your homepage there, and your shack is just loaded with equipment. Why don't you tell us a little bit about all that stuff and, you know, where you got it? If you're a collector, you use it, and what does it all mean?
Okay, well, let me see. Where do I start? First of all, let me back up a few years, if you don't mind. Back in around 1965 or so, my brother and I both were interested in radio. My brother went into the Navy and became a radioman, and spent, I don't know, three, four tours in Vietnam. And then he spent a year in Antarctic, and I took a different route. I decided to get drafted, and so I spent about a little over 30 years on active duty, from two tours in Vietnam all the way over to a tour in Iraq. So I had a break in the radio business, but my brother Mike, by the way, his call sign is K4USV, as in Virginia. That may sound familiar to you, and I'll tell you what that means in just a second. Probably don't mean anything, but means I think it has a little trivia to it. So anyway, my brother got me interested in the Collins. He gave me my first Collins S line setup. And a few years back, quite a few years back, and that kind of got me sparked in the Collins interest, got me interested in the Collins equipment. And it just so happens, the club that I am the president of, that just means that I'm the president, and the gentleman that's been running the club for 1,000 years, just tell me what to do, and I do whatever they tell me to do. But so anyway, one of the members is a gentleman, a mentor, you might say, of mine, in terms of the Collins equipment is, his name is Bill Wheeler, K0DEW. He lives in Lebanon, Missouri, and he is a founder of the Collins Collectors Net, Association, the Collins Collectors Association. So, I've spent a lot of time, looking at and, dreaming about some of the equipment he has. So anyway, I've collected, as you probably saw on my QRZ page, I've collected quite a bit of Collins stuff, equipment. And I try to go after the, what I consider the unique stuff. It's all, everything I have in this room has a story behind it. It's not just, a bunch of equipment that I found here and there, but it all has a story. And I could probably spend all day talking about, some of the stories, about each particular piece of equipment. As an example, if you saw the 30S1, which sits on the floor, that's an amplifier. I was able to get that amplifier from a gentleman called, his name is Bob Heil, over in St. I got it over in, from over in Illinois, from the Heil Sound Company over there. So that was kind of a nice addition to my collection. And I drove down to Alabama, got up one morning, drove to Alabama, and I just happened to find a 30S1, which is, I'm sorry, 30L1, which is an amplifier, and was brand new in the box, never been opened. Gentleman didn't even know what it was. He was selling car parts, and we were talking about car parts, and he says, well, I got this radio you might be interested in. And it turns out it was an amplifier that's, I was the first person to ever take it out of the box, as far as I know, from the Collins factory up in Iowa. So anyway, it's still got the cardboard around the tubes and probably never plug it in.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. We'll be right back with our guest Dale Pruitt, K1 USA, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world. Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to QSO and our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA. Well, let me ask you a question. As far as operating, I mean, do you operate this stuff or you just collect it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've got a bench behind me, and I've got a bench. I'm surrounded by benches, but I'll take a KWM-2A and or either one of the S-lines. I'll sit on the bench and hook one of the amplifiers up and get on the Collins net on Sunday afternoon, or just get on it and work a few people and put it back on the shelf and then take down another one and just kind of rotate them around.
And, let me ask you this question. What do you find, say you compare, a KWM-1, KWM-2 transceiver to a modern day transceiver? What differences do you notice operating these things?
Well, excuse me. Operating is it's a little different, obviously. Take the S line, for example. It has a different transmitter and a different receiver. You have to zero beat every time you change frequencies or go to a different frequency. Basically, have to align the transmitter with the receiver, and it takes a little bit of time. Of course, the KWM-1 is a transceiver, kind of like the modern stuff. Obviously, it doesn't have the new technology, computer wise, and all the digital stuff. But I will tell you, talking to my brother, he knows exactly when I'm on one of the Collins radios, because he says the audio on the Collins radio, because of the tubes, he says I have nothing in this room that compares to the audio on the Collins S line or the Collins KWM-2 or any of the Collins stuff. So in terms of audio, I'd say top of the line. In terms of tuning it up and taking a little bit of time, you're probably not going to use it for DXing or you can use it for DXing, but for contesting, stuff like that, it would be very time consuming. But on a good day, if you got some time and you want to spend with it and you got a little leisurely time, you just set it up on a bench and make a few contacts and then go to another radio.
Well, if you think about it, though, back in the day, that's how people operated all the time, whether it be a contest or anything else. You still had to do the tuning and the zero beating and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure I'm not familiar with the Collins receivers, but I'm sure they have a preselector on them like most of the other receivers. And you probably have to peak the preselector, dip the final, mess with the loading control and do the preselector too on the transmitter. And then when you get on the air, you got a zero beat the receiver, providing the receiver is actually tuned exactly on the frequency the way it should be. So there's things to do, you know, when you go to make a contact, there's things to do. And I guess the thing is that's how folks operated for a long, long time. When we had separates like, oh, for example, even an HT-37, Hallicrafters with a SX-101 Hallicrafters receiver. You still had the same thing. You had two Heathkit, separate transmitter, separate receiver. You had the same thing. You had the Drake twins, same thing. Unless you were operating the VFO off of just one piece, if that makes any sense, and using that VFO for both transmit and receive. But anyhow, that was the way it was done. So I guess what I look at is if we're going to have the fun out of running those old rigs, then we need to make our mind up that, yeah, we got to take a little extra time to do this, but look how rewarding it is to be able to bring a Collins S-line on the air and communicate with it. Or am I off base here somehow?
No, you're right on it. You're 100%. So I guess I can equate it to I've got a 2015 GMC truck. It's got 500 miles on it sitting out in my shop. And I got a 1959 Chevy Sidestep with the roll-up windows and no air conditioner and no air conditioning other than rolling the windows down and no power brakes. So, you know, it's just, I guess it's kind of the same analogy. It's a little more, probably a little more work to it, but no one's going to look at you in that 2015 truck, but you'll get a lot of stares on the 59 Sidestep Chevy truck. I think it's the same analogy with the radio. I think some people will have the ear for it. At least my brother does. And I can't fool him. I've tried to fool him a few times. By the way, he's active too, still active. It's you can't fool him as far as the audio. He knows when I'm on the Collins, and I think I kind of peeked out on Collins. I think I've gotten about everything I would like to have that's out there that I would have, except for a few items, which I don't think I'll ever see. They're getting harder and harder to find. So I'm leaning towards, which is not on my QRZ page, but I'm leaning towards, Drake. I've got a few Drake, transceivers and receivers and transmitters and a couple of Drake amplifiers. So I just, I retired and I've had a lot of this stuff for quite a while and I just enjoy playing with it. I really do. It's always something different. Same thing with the, you know, you asked me, what do I like to do? DXing, but, is up on the top of my list, but boy, there's always something different to do in amateur radio. As far as I'm concerned, I don't think I don't know how anyone could lose interest in it. I've got another friend of mine that lives over in, next town over, K0DEQ, and he does, we do, I say, I'm primarily the driver, but we drive around and do what they call county hunting. Basically, there's 3,077 counties in the United States, and there's people that's actually, there are hands that actually work all 3,077 counties, to include a few folks overseas. That's actually worked every single county to include Hawaii. Well, they don't call them counties, but whatever's equivalent to counties in Alaska and Hawaii. And so it's, like I said, there's always something fun and interesting to do. I don't know if I'll ever get to the honor roll, but I sure enjoy trying to get there. And
well, let me ask you a question. Now, you're collecting Drake equipment now. Uh-huh. So you're probably collecting the R4Cs and T4XC. What differences do you notice between the Drake line and the Collins line when you're operating and listening and all that sort of thing?
Not much. I mean, The Drake came out a few years after some of the vintage Collins stuff, but for me, not a lot of difference in it. There's subtle differences in it, and I think the Drake seems to me to be a little more modern, which it is, in comparison to the Collins. I've got in terms of amateur radio, I've got the first what I not the first but the first transmitters and receivers that came out, which obviously were AM type transmitters, and I've got the first sideband set up, which was called the Goldust Twins. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but
no, not at all.
They came out with a transmitter, a receiver, a power supply, and a speaker, and they call it the Gold Dust Twins. Transmitter, receiver, speaker, and power supply, and it's advertised, I think, around 1,000 watts on the power supply, which I've never gotten it up to that, but was the first commercial sideband. I think that set up back in 19. I'm having a brain cramp here on the exact year, but I'll just say early 60s, 59, 60, somewhere in that time frame. I think that setup back then was close to $4,000, which is a lot of money back then if you bought the complete set brand new. So that's really a nice a really nice piece of equipment. It's getting hard to find, and it's obviously a little more expensive, probably a little more expensive than when it was new, but that's like anything else. It's this collector quality, I guess, inflation and all.
Well, let me ask you this question. If you've messed around with much of the Drake line, this is a question I've always had. What's the difference between the T4XC, using it with the R4C, and the T4XB and the R4B? What differences are there between those radios?
The only Drake I have is the C line, and you put me on the spot on that one, but I think the B line came out before the C line, and there are some differences in it, and I tell you, I can't put my finger on it right now. Just having another cramp here, but the only thing that interests me when I started fooling with the Drake was the C line. That's the only thing I have.
Well, someone was telling me the B line has filters in it that you don't have to add, and that the C line you have to add the filters. At least that's what I was told, but I don't know. Everyone else I've asked, no one seems to know. So I was wondering, because I have a pair of Drake Twins here, the T4XC and the R4C, and I'm very tempted about getting the R4B, just because of the fact they claim that it's decked out with the filters and everything. And a lot of guys seem to prefer that receiver. I don't know. It'd be interesting to own one and just play with it and see, what the difference is. Now, I've got TR4Cs here. I've got several of those. And I've always liked those transceivers, because if you get an amplifier that requires a little extra drive, and a lot of rigs today are not real generous in power output, so... if you're wanting to run the amplifier at its full legal limit, you need the extra power from the TR4C is really a cool thing to have, because then you can run the actual legal limit if that's what you want to do, or at least if you would like just the capability of being able to do it. At least that's the way it seems to me.
Well, I've got two of the L4B amplifiers, and I've never try to max them out as far as power. I'm kind of conservative on anything that's got a little age on it. So anyway, I'm pretty conservative on that. But I tell you, that is an excellent excellent amplifier. If you look up a lot of folks on QRZ, you'll see a lot of people that have the L4B amplifier, and they run it with, I'm assuming, with some of the more modern equipment. So it's a workhorse. That's a workhorse amplifier. And yeah, you're right. I suppose you could put on a good day, 150. you can probably get 150 or more watts out of one of these Drakes. And I'm not sure. I wouldn't drive that amplifier with that much power. That's a workhorse amplifier. I know that.
I've seen amps that run like, say, the example would be the Ameritron, the 1200 that's got the 3CX 1200 tube in it. And that thing requires a fair amount of drive. And if you're watching the grid current, of course, you know that you can't run that much grid current on it, or you know where the cutoff is. But a lot of the rigs out there now will not drive that amplifier to what they consider to be, you know, the normal grid current. They're just too puny. Yep. You know, so I would think when a person is going to spend that kind of money for an amp, I would think they would want to be able, you know, and they may not run it that way all the time, and most people probably wouldn't, but they'd like to be able to run the legal limit if they wanted to do it. And, of course, with some of the radios that I've seen, they won't drive an AL1200 because all they'll put out is 70 watts or something like that, even though they're rated at 100. I'd like to see a rig put out 100 watts, you know, just for no other reason. If you're buying it and it's rated at 100, then I want to see the watt meter give me 100 watts dead carrier. I don't think that should be that big of a problem. But some rigs it is.
It's almost too I don't know if you're going to put this on air or not, but this might be a little embarrassing for me to say this, but I'm surrounded by, I think I counted them the other day, there's in this room right now, there are 11 amplifiers.
Oh, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Amplifiers are a technology, you know, they are part of, and I'll tell you something, you know, people can talk about QRP and it's nice to do QRP and all that, but try to carry on a conversation in the summertime, you know, on 80 meters in the middle of some lightning activity scattered throughout the country. And if you don't have an amplifier, you ain't talking to nobody. You know, you're going to be talking to yourself.
Everything I have in this room is, like I said before, is there's something unique, or I would say maybe different about it for the most part. Some of them might be similar, but there's a story behind it, everything that I have. But I tell you, first of all, let me back up. I have absolutely no training in electronics. I have no training whatsoever in any sort of developing, designing, or when it comes to amplifiers or technology. Everything I know about ham radio, I've basically either read or learned the hard way. But what I was going to say is that if I had to put my money in anything, I would put my money in an antenna.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. We'll be right back with our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to QSO and our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA.
I found it. Antennas, a good antenna. Well, almost in my case, aside from my location, I don't know if I just lucked out. I really got a great location with some excellent takeoffs. But I would say that my 2 cents would go to the antenna and the feed line and so forth, because I can take this Kenwood radio that I've got right now, and I've got to where I very seldom will I turn this amplifier on whatsoever, and I enjoy working DX and stations all over the world without turning the amplifier on. Now, having said that, when there's some a major DX and there's thousands of people calling them, and I have to turn on one of these workhorses to get through the pileups, and I think they have their place, and but generally if I'm on a good day or whatever you want to, I guess if you call it a good day, I'll just try to work them with the this Kenwood I have will do 200 watts, and it's when you said you'd like to get 100 watts out of the radio, that probably means that I'm putting about 150 maybe into the antenna. So if I can get 150 and I can work them, generally speaking, I try not to turn the amplifier on whatsoever, but there are times when I throw in the towel and I'll fire up one of these amplifiers and work a station, because I'm not going to let a DX station go by without it's at least trying to work them.
There you go. I was going to ask you now, with all the equipment that you're collecting and using and all that kind of thing, do you have any sort of rotation system where you come in and say, okay, today it's this rig, and then the next day it's something else you're working and all that. And do you find all of the things work, or do you go to hook one up and all of a sudden it's a non-functional item that now you got to put it on the test bench and get into it and fix it?
Yeah, it's the easy part is getting the smoke out of them. The hard part is putting the smoke back in them. And that's you hit it right on the head. And I try to, and I do have a sort of a rotation system, I guess you might say, when I pick something off the shelf that I know that hasn't been fired up in a while, I'll try to put a variac meter on it. A variac variable power supply on it, and raise it up, you know, to bring the power up. Sometimes I'll let it sit for a while and try to raise it up, but occasionally you'll plug something up and then the smoke comes out. You can't put it back in without taking it apart and putting it on a bench somewhere and getting someone really smart to help you get the smoke back in it. That's what I call us trying to get the smoke back into things.
Well, you know, I'll just say, you know, I was enjoying operating the Drake TR4C, and then all of a sudden the transmit started sticking on. You know, I could have let off on the button, it just stay on, you know. Of course, if I took the one of the controls on the front, I'm trying to think, well, the selector that goes between AM and CW, if I get something like that, or just reach over and turn the volume control, just turn it off, and then I'll then bring the volume control back up, of course, it would work. But now there's something. I've got to get the thing off the shelf, disconnect everything from it, you know, and take it and set it on the bench and go fetch a Drake power supply for it and a dummy load and all that, and then start poking, you know, and try to figure out where it is. The problem is with most guys today, and I don't think I'm all that unique, and that is we just don't have the time. I mean, you'd love doing it. It's actually enjoyable putting a rig on the bench and figuring out what a problem is. It's really de-stressing. If you start tracing the circuit and use a, because you see your mind becomes so focused and so occupied on the troubleshooting part of it, you don't remember any of your troubles or problems or worries. But the problem is getting back to square one, and that is finding the time to do it. So my question to you is, I mean, are you retired at this point?
I am retired, and there's one minor drawback with being retired. I absolutely cannot get a day off.
I see. I hear that. These retired people, they got all these false deadlines. You know, they got more false deadlines now than they did when they were working.
I had a dental appointment, and I said that to the dental technician actually this morning. And I said, I'm retired, but I can't get a day off. She said, what? She didn't get it. I was like, okay, never mind. But yes, I worked, probably a little more, but I worked for 42 years, and I just moved out here in the country, and I guess you call it the country. I can sit on the front porch and see Interstate 44, so I'm not that far fetched from the city life, so to speak. But anyway, I don't know if I would keep from going losing my mind if I didn't have ham radio, because I'm either working on something, building antennas, putting up towers, taking down towers, and just or if I'm not doing it, I'm thinking about it, and in between, I'm on the air trying to work a few stations. But something that came to my mind that you said about the old versus the new. I'm sitting over here looking at this thing. I absolutely cannot run this Kenwood radio without the computer. Everything that's on the initial pictures on my QRZ page is connected to the computer. And boy, what a web I've woven for myself is to, I can't do anything without this computer. From login programs to just basically looking at spotters and so forth and so on. So when you put the S line on a bench, there's no computers, there's no spotters, there's none of that stuff. So you know, you're shooting in the dark, and you work who you can work. So I'd say that if you asked me the difference between the modern and the old, I would say that computer technology, which believe it or not, my last 12 years that I did work, I was a computer. This is kind of scary, but I was actually developed scenarios for a combat training environment for the military. So that's kind of scary thought. But anyway, it's scary in that computers. You can love them and you can hate them. When I get, I don't know why I work myself and painted myself into a corner, but I've got this thing set up now that, the only thing I use basically is this mouse. I can basically control the amplifier, the, spotting program, the logging program, the rotator, you name it. I can basically control it with the mouse, and, even the radio I can control with the click of a mouse. So if you take that out of the equation, I'd be lost. I'd really be lost if I didn't, wasn't able to use all that. And actually kind of made me lazy, but, boy, it's so nice to be able to click on a spotter. You click on the person's call sign, and it brings up his information, and you, another click of the mouse, and it turns your antenna, the rotor for you. And, you can turn I can turn the amplifier on and control it from the computer. So, technology, what can I say? But it's fun. It's fun to do, but sometimes you want to kind of relax and get out of the mainstream, bring up the Drake or the Collins, and there you have it. Slow down a little bit, at least for me anyway.
Well, what are your favorite ham bands? Where do we find you? Are you all over the place, or do you have a particular, several frequencies that you tend to hang out on? Now, I'm on 75, 80 meters almost all the time, and if I'm not there, I'm probably up on 17. So, I mean, that's it for me. I mean, I'm saying I don't operate anywhere else. I'm just saying that that's just generally, seemingly, where I wind up for some reason. So I'm curious about your operating habits there.
My operating habits is follow the DX spotter. If there's a DX station and I haven't worked them out, that's where I'll be. Anywhere from 10 meters to 160, phone, CW, or digital. And recently I got into a friend of mine, Tom, KN4JX, got me into this JT65, which is it's slow. I won't mean mouth it. I'll just say it's slow. But it's a good contact, and didn't take it much power to do it. And it's, once you work them, it's pretty much confirmed. And I'm big on logbook of the world. I love Logbook of the World. Don't get me wrong. I'll send out cards, but boy, I love that Logbook of the World thing. It's kind of instant gratification when you make contact with someone and they upload you and you upload them the Logbook of the World, and it's a kind of a done deal. But anyway, to answer your question, my brother and I usually get on up in the like around 180, somewhere like that, and we'll kind of chew the fat and so to speak, and we have people come on and they know that we're talking to each other, if I'm not on the radio or my brother's not on the radio, people will come on and say, "Where's Mike?" My brother, they'll ask him where am I at, and it's kind of a.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. We'll be right back with our guest Dale Pruitt, K1 USA, right after this. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, "I want to win," because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, U-N-S-E-E-N-B-E-A-N, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener. He is the owner of the Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to QSO and our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA.
I would say for the most part, if we're rag chewing kind of, so to speak, we'll start off on around 20 meters, and then we'll go up to we'll go down to 40 meters, depending on what the band and the conditions are like. But generally speaking, if I'm not talking to him or my friend Tom, we're probably DXing. I'm probably DXing somewhere. That's probably that's my biggest enjoyment. Like I said, it's the hunt and the catch kind of deal, and the gratification of.
Well, what kind of antennas are you using for your DXing? And let me ask this question: have you ever used any real long wire antennas?
Yep, absolutely. I've got a long wire. I've got a Carolina Wyndham, and it's basically for low bands, 160. 80 and well, I don't use it for 40, but 80, 160 and 80. And this summer I put up a beverage antenna. I ran it. I've got 28 acres. So I ran a long wire out, toward, I've got a pond down at the bottom of the hill that I live on. And there's actually a picture of it on the QRZ, but I ran I think it was 80 feet, or I can't remember exact length of it. I know it was a wavelength of 160, which, and I, took about 40 feet of, wire and I threw it off in the pond. So hopefully I used the, was using the pond as a counterpoise, so to speak. And, but anyway, I love to receive on the beverage. It basically cuts out all the noise.
Let me ask you a question here. Yeah. I'm going to show my antenna ignorance for everybody to see. Can you not transmit off of a beverage?
No.
When I was a kid, I guess I did something dumb, but here's what I did. I had a 500-foot long wire.
Mm-hmm.
It was 500 feet long, and I just stretched it all the way out, got it up as high as I could get it. And at the time, I connected it to a little box. I don't know if they still make them. It was called a Unique Wire Tuner.
Mm.
And I've seen them around, but I tune it up. And it would tune up just fine, that 500-foot piece of wire. And I was working it, I guess, against just earth ground. Well, anyhow, at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning, when I could hear nothing on my dipole, I could hear Europe, and I could talk to them. It was back and forth, two-way communications, and friends of mine across town, they said, wait a minute, I can't even hear that guy. And I had one fella that had a beam, and he turned the beam. He had the heading all figured out as to which way to turn it to the person I was talking to. He couldn't hear the guy, couldn't hear a thing, nothing.
Yep.
And yet this 500-foot piece of wire...
Yep.
But then I've been told you don't transmit on a beverage, and I would think 500 feet would classify as a beverage antenna. Unless there's other things that make a beverage antenna a beverage antenna, I don't know. This was just a 500-foot straight shot from back behind the house out into the fields as far as I could go with it. And it was up as high as I could get it. And it was amazing. I mean, I couldn't believe what I saw with it. I thought I could, you know, just I had friends come over at 2 o'clock in the morning just to watch us work Europe on 20 meters when 20 was just shut down. You know, at least we thought that we thought it was shut down. But go ahead, comment now. I want to hear you explain this.
Okay, I'm gonna give you. I'll probably get a lot of hate mail if anybody listens to this or if you put it on the air. I'll probably get a little hate mail hate mail meaning people are probably going to tell you that I don't have a clue what I'm talking about, and they're probably going to be too far off. But it sounds like to me what you had was a in-fed random wire antenna as opposed to a beverage antenna. On the beverage antenna, you have on the far end, it's terminated with a 400, and there's different types, but the one I had was it's terminated with a 450 ohm resistor. And on this end, there's a little commercial kit that you can buy, and that I want to say probably some sort of capacitor that's built into this little box, which I'm assuming turns it into a beverage antenna. But my friend of mine has what you just mentioned. He's got a 500 foot random wire he just put up in a tree, and it's in fed, meaning that he just feeds it right into his shack, and he transmits and receives on that antenna, which sounds like what you had, as opposed to what I guess is classified as a receive beverage antenna. Now, I'm sure someone's going to say, yeah, you can transmit on it, but in my configuration, I could not transmit on it because on my radio, which is a Kenwood 990, I use the cable that for cable TV, and it screws right in the back of the radio. There's a separate connector port for that receive antenna, and I ran it out to this little kit thing, which I think is a capacitor on one end and a 450 ohm resistor on the other end, which to me, from my understanding, makes it a receive only beverage antenna. And by the way, this antenna was only three feet off the ground, and wasn't very high. But I would say what it sounds like to me is in your particular case. Again, I'm not. First of all, I'm not an expert on this or anything else, but it sounded like to me you just had a random wire antenna, and my answer would be yes, you could transmit and receive on that both, as opposed to what I had developed. I didn't develop it. I put it up. I bought a little kit and I put out the beverage antenna. So does that make any sense? Whatsoever?
Yeah, that makes sense. And the only thing is, I remember people telling me, well, you got to terminate that. And I had a fella come over, brought some non-inductive, you know, resistors to terminate the end of the 500-foot wire. And it was really interesting because whenever we terminated it, on the receive end, the sensitivity seemed to really drop. In other words, it was strange because I thought, well, maybe it's just, maybe we have noise in a particular direction, and by terminating it, we are no longer listening in that area. But I began to fool with it a little bit, and I came to the conclusion, no, that's not it. The resistor was actually messing up the 500-foot long wire. So I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I know people that have ran beverage antennas for receive, you know, but I've yet to talk to anybody that would run a 500-foot long wire. But I'm going to tell you something, and this is true. I had a chance to repeat this again at another location by running 500-foot of wire out, and I didn't use a unique wire tuner. I used some kind of jury-rigged tuning device, and experienced just about the same thing. And what I mean is at 2 o'clock in the morning, There were signals in there that you could not hear on a dipole. You couldn't hear them on a beam. Now, I don't know, maybe if you spent the time rotating the beam back and forth and listening carefully, maybe you could have heard it, but these signals were loud enough to communicate with. And so something magical happens when you start stretching wire way out, and you start getting multiple wavelengths of the frequency that you're operating on. It begins to behave differently. Now, there's a lot of, I know there's engineering people out there that are listening and thinking, you, Ted, you stupid thing, you don't you know that the way this works is, you know, and they could explain it to me, and I still wouldn't understand it. But, I would encourage anybody, if you ever have the opportunity to run a 500-foot piece of wire, you know, and I'm not so convinced it's got to be perfectly straight. I'm thinking that you can kind of, you know, if you have to go down the yard a couple hundred feet and then turn to the right 30 feet and then go back the other way for, you know, whatever. I think, antennas are just really, really interesting, I think. You know, even though I don't understand very much about them. The one thing I did learn, though, in broadcast radio, and that is especially with FM, and that is that antenna had better be resonant and it had better terminate at 50 ohms. And why I say that is because there's so many people out there, and antenna companies, that will leave your radio station with the antenna resonant at 103.5 when you're broadcasting at 102.1. I'm sorry, folks. It doesn't work so good. But they will tell you that it does, because the way they have it broadbanded, your standing wave at your transmit frequency is acceptable. You know, but I keep looking at that antenna and thinking to myself, if I hit it with a hammer, you know, it's going to resonate at 103.5 where it's tuned, or physically where that thing is physically at 103.5. And I don't care what kind of donuts you put in the line. I don't care what you do to it, you know, until you tune it to the frequency you're transmitting on, you know, you're compromised, and that's just all there is to it. But you try to tell that to one of these antenna companies that specializes in screwed up antennas, okay? I mean, I've said enough. I don't know. I don't know if you've been around broadcast radio. You may know what I'm talking about, but then again, you may not. I don't know.
I know how to turn on the radio, but that's about it. But as far as the broadcast, well, so anyway, the drawback with the first of all, very few of my friends, local friends, believed that I could actually hear these stations that I claim that I'm hearing.
That's another thing. You know, I had to call people on the phone and hold the radio, the phone. Listen, can you hear the guy? You know, no, these are not voices in my head, you know. But go ahead.
So I did the same thing, a little different. I made a little took my phone and recorded it, and I sent it to him. And there's, the gentleman over in next town over, he says, it's bad enough that you're working stations. He says, it's bad enough I question whether you're working them, because I can't, absolutely cannot hear the person that you're talking to. What made it even worse for him was, and he's joking, of course, but he says, you spotted him and put him on the spotter and said he was a 599 or a 5.9. He says, I cannot believe that. I was like, well, he was. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It literally just absolutely cuts the noise out to a point where you where you can actually hear the guy just as clear as he could be. Now, the drawback to the beverage in my case is that when I ran it, the tail end of it down that I terminated in the pond from my corner of the house, it was at like a 45-degree angle, which favored Europe. And the disadvantage to that is, obviously, is Asia and other places like that. So this year, fall, I'm going to experiment. I think I'm going to go off the deep end, and I'm going to try this Now that I'm convinced about the receive antennas, I think I'm going to try one of these four square antennas, meaning that you can switch the direction of it and I guess point it towards Europe or Asia or Africa or Antarctic or whatever, whichever direction you want to try to work a station in. Whereas it, the beverage is pretty much oriented toward, the way I had it oriented towards, toward Europe. Now back to the long wire question. I think you gave away one of my trade secrets, when you said at 4 o'clock in the morning, you could hear these stations. To me, that's, the trade secret there is the gray line. if you know how to work, the gray line, you'll work a lot of DX stations. And it took me a while to figure that system out with the help of, my friend down in Lebanon, Bill Wheeler. He pounded in my head that you gotta work them, when the opportunity knocks, you have to be there to work them. And basically it's following the gray line. In other words, if you're going to work, let's say Wake Island, you may have in my case, I worked Wake Island on 160 on that Carolina Windham. And I had, I'd say probably a 3 to 4 minute opening. In other words, I heard them and then they went away and I was able to work them. And it's basically, following the gray line. And, in other words, when the sun's just coming up or going down in Wake Island, you gotta be on the air and you gotta be listening. And, of course it doesn't hurt to have a good receive antenna. And that's why I'm going to hopefully build or invest in one of those four square type antennas this coming year. But I'll probably still leave my beverage antenna out and use that. I'd say the one that made me the most money, and if you want to call it that, is the Step IR antenna. It's just absolutely, I'm not sure you can beat it. I'm sure again, there's folks will argue that point, but that's okay. And of course, folks will tell you that they don't sign up for the concept of it because there's too many moving parts and they have the possibility of breaking down or whatever. But the one I had up for 5 or 6 years has never had one problem with it whatsoever. Except for once, we clocked in, on my, weather station. I clocked in one afternoon, winds of 105 miles an hour. Of course, that was a gust. And it was pretty strong and it turned it up in the air a little bit, but it didn't affect it whatsoever. So I've never had an issue with that one.
Well, tell me a little bit about the Step IR. Now we see it every year set up at Dayton on a tower. And it looks different than all the other beam antennas. Tell us, what's the difference and what's the claim to fame and why are you so high on this antenna?
Well, basically, you can adjust that antenna to make it resonant on basically any frequency, any portion of the band, and you can with or without a tuner, you can adjust it to where there's basically it's flat in terms of SWR, and it's an adjustable antenna. That's probably the and I think and I keep saying this, but I'm sure there's people disagree with me on this, but it's you're tuning at the antenna, so basically, as far as I'm concerned, there's no loss in the line, or there's no loss in the antenna between the feed line and the antenna, because again, once you adjusted it, just the antenna to that frequency, you basically adjusted the SWR to where it's completely flat, which is basically 1.0 for the most part for me, because I've got it to where I can adjust it down to nothing. So, and I've got a high gain TH7, it's actually a little bit, it's probably 10, 15 feet higher than the stepper, but it just, you just can't, it depends on what part of the band that you're operating in as to which one will outperform the other. But as an example, we've had ice storms and snow storms and so forth, and the stepper will droop a little bit if it gets a little ice on it. But again, I can adjust it. I can adjust, make adjustments to it, and adjust that SWR to where it's at resident. The high gain TH7 I have, there's no adjustment to it. When it gets ice on it, it takes it so far out of, it takes it so far out, it's really hard to tune it with the tuner that I have. So I would say that's a money maker right there. It's an excellent antenna. And I will tell you, the antenna that I have, as a matter of fact, I don't have it up. I took it down and I'm passing this one on to a friend of mine, and I'm putting up a different one. That's how much I like it. This one I've got that we just took down last week or so was about 60 feet, and it was a three element stepper. Next month. I guess next month is tomorrow, but next month I'm going 120 feet, Rhone 45, and I'm putting a DB36, which is the granddaddy to the three element, and there's only one bigger than that, and I just decided to go with the one right under the DB42. But if there's a DX station and someone's trying to work him, and if I'm on a three element stepper and he says he's on a four element, I just let him go, because I know he's going to work him before I do. But hopefully that'll change here pretty soon. But I said this early on that amplifiers or not, I put my money in the antennas. And I think if you have the right antenna, and I've got a few antennas up. I've got a vertical, and I've got the wire dipoles, and I've got the stepper, and I got the TH7, and they all do something different. And I've actually worked stations on the TH7 I couldn't work on the stepper, and vice versa. But for the most part,
how could that be that the TH7 would not work a station that the stepper, or the stepper couldn't hear a station that the TH7 could? How do you think that works?
Well, I'm not sure that it's the fact that you can't hear him. I think it, and like I said, depending on, to me, it depends on if I can hear him a little bit better on the stepper or the TH7. And I think in my case, you got to remember that this TH7 is at about 75 feet. The stepper was at about 60 feet. Attribute it to that, depending on what region I'm talking to. If it's Europe, because I favor Europe, because of my takeoff, the stepper will always outperform the TH7. But it seems like Asia, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, places like that, seems like the TH7 might have a little bit of an edge. Not very much. But sometimes it will have a little bit of an edge over them, and it depends on what part of the band that they're in. Again, of course, because my brother put that up for me, and he tuned it to the TH7. He tuned it to a specific frequency. So if that person is operating within a small portion of that frequency, then you can't beat it. But generally speaking, across all the bands, all the modes, steppers, hands down, because it's adjustable. And I would say that very seldom will a TH7 outperform the stepper. It's just
I'm gonna jump guns here on you. We're gonna go down a different road here. Now you like working DX. This is something you just love to do. Now, is this primarily phone or what about CW?
Both.
Okay. Now let's move into the phone arena here for a minute, and let's talk to all the guys out there in ham radio that are just getting started, and they're kind of afraid of working DX. Now, here's something I found about DX. I sometimes just can't understand the guy. I'll hear him talking, and he's conversing with someone else. So there's a break. There's nobody talking, so I'd throw my call out, and he would come back, and I would have to ask him what his QTH was like six times because I couldn't understand what he was saying. Now, I felt very self-conscious about that. And a couple of the fellows says, oh, no, you got the whole wrong idea. You don't feel self-conscious. You continue to ask until you can make out what he's saying. Sometimes the guy has to slow down or pronounce a little bit better or something. So I'm saying this, if this is something you're interested in, why don't you give us a little primer? Especially for the newbies coming into ham radio, is what tips would you give them about working DX? How do you go about it, and how do you do it successfully?
Well, I would say for the new person that really wants to work DX and they want to get into it is to get get themselves a good computer. There's thousands of, well, not thousands, there's probably hundreds of programs out there that have spotters. And every spotter that you see will have the person's call sign, his location. And I'll be honest with you, probably 80% of the time when I work a DX station, I actually know where he's at. And most of the time I'll look him up if someone put him on a spotter, I'll look his call sign up and see where he's located for a couple of reasons. One, if you're running a Yagi, antenna beam, you want to turn that antenna toward that person. Obviously it'll give you a little better chance of, working that DX station. And basically, if you don't have a computer, if you don't want to use a login program, some people don't. They're not interested in computers whatsoever. But so in that case, I would say you just have to listen. And somewhere along the line, you will hear his call sign. And I can almost tell you to the country if you give me their prefix, I can almost tell you. Well, this is a few years of experience, but for a new person.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. We'll be right back with our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA, right after this. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email, and be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com.
Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to QSO and our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA.
Once he learns the call prefixes and the regions, and I wouldn't let that hold me back. If a new ham wants to work DX, jump in there, write his call sign down, and look him up on the computer. And of course, unfortunately, nowadays are not required to keep a log, but I log every single person I talk to, I log in.
Well, you know, I mean, I've listened, like, say, for example, a lot on the 17-meter band. These guys would be in there rattling off their call sign, and I'll tell you, after 30 minutes or 40 minutes of listening to the same guy, I still could not understand his call sign. And, I mean, yeah, he would fly with it so fast, you know. And yeah. I would think if you're wanting to work DX, you know, in let's say you're in a foreign country, I would think your dialect, you know that they can't understand you perfectly. So it seems to me you'd give your call sign out slowly and concisely so that the other people could hear it, write it down, and know what it is you're saying. I found a lot of these DX stations just rattle it right off. Like my call sign's WB8PUM. And okay, so there's some guy listening to me overseas that doesn't necessarily speak
really good English, and if I come on and say WB8POM, you know, CQDX, WB8POM, WB8POM, calling out whatever, that all to them it's garbage because it's slurred. You know, and if I say WB8POM, and then I use some phonetics with it, it seems to me that's what people would want to do. But I'll tell you, I don't hear that coming from these guys that are attempting to work the United States from Europe. All I hear is that's true with Japan as well. All I hear is their gobbledygook. Now, if you sit there and listen long enough, I actually recorded these guys and took the recording and played it for several people, and I slowed it down. Can you understand what they're saying? Everybody shake their head. No. You know, but yet there's another ham out there, and he hears it, and he's bam. He knows exactly what the guy's saying. So it must be like CB lingo or something. I mean, where it's a dread secret only to the person that's been at it a while. I don't know. Tell me about this. Am I crazy? Is this, you know?
Absolutely not. To add to that, confusion is a lot of those DX stations, you may listen to them for a half hour before they even say their call sign. You just hear him answering K1USA or KN4GX, and that's all you hear is, I'm like, okay, what is, you know, because to me, before I call him, I want to know who I'm calling, because, you know, even though I may think that this DX station is on this frequency, it may not even be him. It might be some guy in Columbia that I've worked 1,000 times, but it's tough. I think that's a learned
some kind of characteristic on the receive side. But I mean, I've heard this so much that I think it's a problem. I don't think it's just me. I think it's a problem. I mean, I've got pretty good hearing, and I'm sitting there and I'm listening, and if in 45 minutes I can't tell what this guy's call sign is, and he says it over and over, and I record him, you know, and then I slow it down and I'm listening, I'm thinking, what is he saying, you know? And I realize it's a foreign language. I understand this is a foreign language. But letters are pronounced, say, for example, the people in France are going to pronounce letters differently than us, but if they slow down, they're recognizable.
Here's a good example for you. My brother's call sign is K4USV. Invariably, everyone that answers him will say K4USB, as in Bravo. I don't know why they. I mean, it's clear as a bell to me, but they almost always say K4USB as in Bravo, and his call is K4USV as in Victor or as in
Virginia. Well, you know, that's a common problem because you can say C, and as soon as you hear that E sound in C, it's easy to mistake it for the letter C, the letter P, the letter G, you know, and I've heard that a lot on the DX, in people communicating with DX. But I have a problem with just in the U.S. I can pick up the phone and they'll say, who's calling? And I'll say, this is Ted, okay? And then the guy will get on the phone and say, hello, Chad. I say, no, it's not Chad, it's Ted. There's a difference, you know? But on the phone or over ham radio, what seems like just glaring, you know, a glaring example that you would have to be an idiot not to be able to understand that I'm saying Ted, okay? But once it passes through, say, for example, single sideband and some noise and all that, the ear just hears what it wants to, you know, what it's the most familiar with. So you may be missing consonant sounds and other little subtleties, you know, that you would normally have. So it sounds on the other end like the guy saying Chad, you know. So I've ran into that a lot. You know, it's kind of funny, but and I've listened to call signs, and I've listened and wrote them down, and I thought I was right. And then I would go to sign with the guy, and I would give the call sign that I thought he had said, and then he would correct me. You know, like you said, you know, it's not, you know, it's not Echo, it's Victor, you know.
Well, this is I have no high frequency hearing whatsoever, due to the fact that 30 years in the United States Army infantry, in other words, helicopters, flying in helicopters for 30 years and loud weapons and so forth. So I have no high frequency hearing whatsoever, which is advantage or disadvantage, I guess. I can pretty much understand and I can hear normal voice conversation. But if your watch goes off, I cannot hear it whatsoever. Now
have you ever had it measured to see what your cutoff point is?
Zero. I mean, it's about as bad. It's as bad as you can get, basically. And
well, I mean, they can sweep your hearing, you know, and you can go up in frequency, and then wherever it starts to roll off, then you would know what that frequency is where you're starting to lose. And I know anybody that gets older, if you're in your 50s, you're not going to hear the frequencies you heard when you were in your 20s. You know, it's just that simple. It will roll off. Now, you don't notice it, at least most people don't, you know. But where you will notice it, like if I go in to adjust an audio processor at a radio station, I'll have the high frequencies kicked up higher than what most women would want to listen to because they're just not there for me, see? So I have to be real careful about that, and I always commission someone younger to kind of man the controls. There's a lot of radio engineers that won't do that, and you can always tell because you tune in their station and it sounds like it's coming out of a tin can or something. The high frequencies are so shrill. And you can't tell them guys either. Say, hey, you know, it doesn't sound good. Sounds perfectly good to me, you know. So, you know, hearing is kind of subjective, but I would at least try to get the hearing checked out to the point where you realize what your roll-off frequencies are.
Yeah, they've told me. I've had it checked 100 times. And unfortunately for me, because of my situation, a couple of hundred thousand other people, it wasn't feasible to wear hearing protection. I know people can say that all day long, but, I could give you 100 reasons why I didn't wear hearing protection. Anyway, that's, we're talking about, an issue that goes back to when I was since I've been 18. So basically all my life, I've had no, I actually haven't had any high frequency hearing because once I landed in the jungle, it's been that way. But anyway, so it has this advantage. A friend of mine sitting over here, and we're listening out for a DX station, and he says, "Holy mackerel! I can't understand what the guy's saying because of the heterodyne is from people tuning up or whatever." He says "You can't hear that." I go, "Nope." And I said, "But I can hear that guy talking, though."
You got your own built-in filter there, yeah. Well, let me ask a question here. Tell me, you know, let's go back to the beginnings here with you. And what attracted you into ham radio? Or how did you even find out there was such a thing as ham radio?
Oh, well, that goes back to 65. Our stepfather was a ham. My brother got into ham radio, and then of course that attracted me. Unfortunately for me, like I said, my brother went on to be a radioman in the Navy, and of course my track took me off to other places and with careers and moving 1,000 times. Not literally, but moving a lot and traveling and it just wasn't feasible. But probably here in the last 10-15 years, I just kind of eased back into it, and so I'd say it started back in the mid-60s and ended up to where I'm at right now. And I'm having to do a lot of catching up with some of the what I consider some of the local club members that we have here that's been doing it constantly from day one for the last 50 years. And
what was your, let's say, for example, what was your first ham rig? And did you ever, were you ever involved in Citizens Band at all?
Yes, a little bit. Not as much as, I mean, I just didn't, it didn't, I was in, involved in it, but wasn't really attracted to it because some reason it just didn't seem legal to me. I don't know why. I just,
it wasn't. It wasn't legal for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a problem with that. So I just did, you know, kind of dabble in it and listen to people talk about it and so forth. But I'd say between my brother and our stepfather, who was a ham, probably pointed me in that direction. So that's probably my kind of mentors back in the 60s. My most recent mentors, the local club members that like I said has been doing it for over 50 years at and for example, Bill over in Rolla. I'm not sure there's anything that he hasn't done in ham radio, and I talk to him all the time and ask him, you know, questions about, you know, what keeps your interest for constantly. I mean, for nonstop for over 50 years, and he says there's different things to do. I mean, if you you can chase DX, you can work all states, you can work counties. I mean, this is something that. You can work digital, you can work, I mean, there's something in this hobby that I would say that could keep your interest or a young person, hopefully a young person's interest in it, for a long time. If he really sticks with it and enjoys it, as much as I do and some other people, I mean, there's some really, really smart people out there. And, I just, I guess, I'm kind of envious of them because boy, there's some really intelligent, people when it comes to this hobby that, that can rattle off, antenna, computers, radios. And I just sit back and kind of listen and learn on it. But
let's get back to this now. What was your very first ham rig that you can remember that you had that was yours that you ran? I mean, was it separate? Well, separate transistor?
I almost have to slide over to my desk. I got a picture of me sitting in front of this rig back in probably '65, and I want to say it's a Hallicraft. It's something, you know, Hallicraft, receiver, transmitter, that kind of, that type of, rig. So it's, obviously some of the earlier stuff, Hallicraft and, Heathkit, that kind of stuff.
I always remember that the first, CW transmitter that I actually had and put on the air was one of those Amicos. And they were dirt cheap. You bought this little kit. I think there's just like one tube in it, I think, if I remember right. I don't know. I have a difficult time. It was obviously rock bound. And, you know, and I had a Hallicrafter's SX100, I think it was, which was a general coverage receiver, but it had a band spread on it. I mean, a lot of guys had the 100. And I used that, that little Amico transmitter. It's interesting now because I see those things for sale on eBay, and I'm going to tell you, they weren't worth the powder to blow them out of the ground. I mean, they were so problematic. Mine chirped like crazy. You know, you'd go to send them drip, 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 drip. You know, you'd have to play with the power supply capacitance and I don't know, the keying circuit. I didn't think the keying circuit was all that good. Of course, I wasn't smart enough to fix it. But anyways, I see them on eBay for $100, $200, $300. They're just crazy. What in the world do people see in them old things? But anyways,
I guess.
That's what I actually started off with. I was so glad to get another.
Hey, Another you still hear some of those chirpers every now and then. you get on the go down the CW portion, you hear chirp, chirp, chirp.
Well, I got a CW transmitter though that was homebrew. Another fella built it, and I brought it home. And it was rock solid, stable. It had multiple crystals in it. You could switch from one to the other and all that. No VFO. Yeah. You weren't allowed to have a VFO with a novice ticket, but that was really satisfying to get something that didn't chirp, you know. And then later I built a couple of CW transmitters and really enjoyed building them. They were fun to build, and the ones I built worked, and they didn't chirp. So another kit that I built was the Ico 753, which was the Drift-O-Matic or whatever. Boy, that thing, you could put a motor clock drive on the PTO and it would have it track because it just drifted. I've never seen anything drift like that before. I mean, I don't think I've ever encountered a radio that drifted like the 753 did.
I meant to tell you earlier, I lost my train of thought, but I was going to tell you before I forget. Some people like it, some people don't, but talking about vanity calls, my brother, as I mentioned, his call was K4USV. My brother spent a year in the Antarctic, and he was a operator and did phone patches and so forth with the Collins and so forth. But his call sign in the Antarctic was KC4USV. His name is Mike. My brother's name is Mike. So, it's been a couple of years ago, but I was sitting here and just kind of tuning around the bands. Wasn't much activity on. It was in the middle of the day. I know it was on the 26th of December because that's my daughter's birthday. And I could hear this real faint station. And I got part of the call and kind of figured out it was in the Antarctic. So I turned the antenna toward Antarctic. And the guy says, this is KC4USV. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I said, well, my brother was in Antarctic in 1970 or 70, 71. And his name is Mike. And I said, I asked the guy what his name was. He said, his name was Mike. So I said, I got chill bumps on my arm. So I'm talking to Mike, KC4USV in the Antarctic. And then, what's this, 50 years gone. So I called my brother on the phone and held the phone up to the radio. And he was like, he couldn't hardly believe it. So I thought that was kind of neat. Anyway, so he came back. Obviously, put in for a vanity call, which is K4USV, dropping the C. But so anyway, I thought that was kind of a neat deal right there. That two guys named Mike, both of them operating KC4USV, both of them were in the Antarctic, what, 50 years apart. So I thought that was kind of a neat deal.
You probably thought that you had encountered a riff in the time continuum.
Yeah. I'd look around and see if there's any UFOs in here or whatever. But
there you go.
Hey, there's something you said probably about an hour or so ago that kind of struck a thought in my head. Was you said something about lightning. This is on the 6th of August last year, I had one horrific lightning bolt hit a short strike. It wasn't a direct hit on the antenna or any of the equipment or any of the outside antennas, but basically it took out everything that I had plugged in and everything from the amplifier to the Kenwood, the rotator, you name it. So I would say to a new ham or any ham, as far as that goes, lesson learned. Read about lightning, read about and study grounding and how to properly ground your equipment and because I'll tell you that is pretty devastating.
Well, working in broadcast radio, I can tell you lightning is one of the strangest phenomena in that it does things that, well, let's put it this way. I've seen it blow phone boxes off of a wall. I've seen it come in and totally toast one piece of equipment in a rack. I mean, burn it to a crisp and leave all the rest of the same in that same rack, leave everything untouched. No rhyme or reason, you know. So, go ahead.
Well, as much as I've read on this, and you would say, you got to be kidding me. This is one of those you got to be kidding me moments. And I almost hate to say this, but as much as I thought I knew about grounding and having everything properly grounded and so forth, and like I said, the house that we live in was built by an engineer, he's put in so much high end stuff into this house that you would think, well, you wouldn't even think about this question or this statement I'm about to make. But here's a long story short: my house and the electrical system was not grounded. Period. And the reason I found out, the reason I knew that, and I never even thought to look. I mean, you would think as much as you studied and read and understand to even get your license, you would think you'd know a little bit about equipment, grounding, lightning, so forth and so on. But the long story short is I called my power company, and I said, I took a lightning strike, and I don't think my house is properly grounded. I said, I've got a workshop out across the driveway, and I took the young kid. It was a young kid. He came out, and I walked him over. And I said, there's a grounding rod right here for the workshop. I walked him over to the house, and I said, where's the grounding rod for this house? He said, well, I got some good news and bad news for you. I said, okay, give me the bad news. He says, you see that pole right there? I said, yep. He says, we are responsible from that pole out to the main head end. You are responsible from the pole to the house. So, of course, I changed my attitude, not blaming it on an electric company. So I asked him, I said, can you come down and look at my electric box? And I want to, you know, can you tell me if it's properly grounded or not? So we went down, we pulled the cover off the electric box. I did, the 200 amp service box. And he said, I got some more bad news for you. I said, what's that? He says, this entire house, I can't believe it didn't burn down, but your entire house is not grounded. I says, oh, are you kidding me? He says, you see those three main lugs coming into your house, right next to the center one. There's another little small lug, and on that lug there should be a copper wire that goes from there to the outside to a grounding rod. And I absolutely did not have one, nor did I know that, nor did I look at it. Assumption. The assumption is that whoever built the house and whoever inspected it would have caught that, but apparently they must have been working Friday afternoon and they just forgot to ground it. So the question would be to everyone that would listen to this, not sure who would, but if the question would be, do they know if their house is properly grounded or not? And I'm not sure everyone could honestly answer that question. And I posed that question to a lot of people that I know, and they said, well, honestly, I don't know, putting it that way, I'm not sure whether it is or not. When that lightning strike hit, it basically took out every TV, basically anything that was plugged in. It was electronic because the lightning traveled in through the neutral, which hit the ground into the 220 service box, and then it hit everything that was plugged in. So that's just absolutely mind-boggling to me that what happened and how it how that whole thing.
I want to change directions here because we're getting close to being yep. out of time. But I want to change directions here just for the moment and ask you: Are you active at this point in a local club of some kind? Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me just a little bit about the club. We don't have a whole lot of time, but tell us a little bit about who they are, the name of the club, and also what kind of activities they engage in.
Well, the club is in Lebanon, Missouri, and like I said, I think I mentioned it earlier, they for the last three years or so, they appointed me as a president. Don't know why, but I think they could have had a lot of better choices. But
and the name of the club is
the Lebanon Amateur Radio Club.
Okay,
Lebanon, Missouri, and it's on the website, and we put on a convention. Couple of years ago, we held a convention here in Lebanon, or there in Lebanon. I'm not right in Lebanon, but we do the Route 66 on the air every year, Whiskey 6 Oscar. We're obviously involved in emergency responder types activities and weather spotting and weather data type stuff, emergency response type stuff,
And I take it you're working directly with the National Weather Service. And about your local emergency coordination center at the law enforcement buildings? Do you work with those folks?
Yep. We work really, really close with the EOC for weather-related and disaster-related type stuff. You probably heard about the devastating tornado in Joplin, Missouri, a few years back. We were club and some of our members was the first and only communications for quite a while on the ground. So that's along with this being a hobby. That's kind of our obviously one of the things that.
Do you do any classes, any training of for the technician test and so on and so forth?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we actually have teach classes on for technicians and primarily for the technicians, and then and we have given classes for general type, but once you get past that, it's pretty much we give the exams. The club gives the exams for any extra general or the technicians. But so short answer is yes, we do all of those.
You'll have to contact your club members and tell them to listen to the QSO radio show and listen to you on the radio talk about all kinds of things here. So but we're out of time, and I want to say thank you so much for joining us. There's a man with the most unique amateur radio call sign I've encountered, K1USA.
Hey, there's a lot of I'm finding out there's a ton of prefixes suffixes with USA. Matter of fact, I just got a CD from DX Position. It was in what was it? I'm having a senior moment here. Anyway, I was over in Africa, and they sent me a CD, and one of the main guys there was JA3USA. So there's a guy in Cook Island that's got a USA call, a 551 something USA, and there's all the USAs have taken up in the United States, as far as I know, and.
Well, listen, we are absolutely out of time at this point, so I'm going to have to say 73 to you. Dale Pruitt's been with us, K1USA. I really appreciate your company. You'll have to come back and talk with us some more. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's Q QSORadioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. That's about all the time we've got for QSO this week. We want to invite you to tune in again next week. You can hear QSO on WTWW at 1 p.m. Central Daylight Time on 9475. And then again in the evenings at 7 p.m. Central Daylight Time at 7 p.m. We want to say thanks to our guest, Dale Pruitt, K1 USA, and 73.